I think this is designed to make me feel even more like a spaceman. Are we on? I'm plugged into my oxygen supply. That's good. As Richard said, I am from England. I have some very distant connections with Scotland, so I need to come clean there now. I've never lived or worked in Scotland, so it may well be that you find my examples just over-specific to the English scene, whatever that means. But I hope you'll find that there's a good transfer value of the principles behind some of the vocabulary of ideas. Now, I want to allow plenty of time for us to exchange ideas and to unpack some of the principles of what I'm saying, which will offer something of a backdrop. And then between us, we can bolt on some more of the practical ideas, which I'm going to get us going on as well. Now, I began my ministry in the late 80s, that is full-time Christian ministry, and it was about the time when many English churches were waking up to the notion that the Billy Graham-type one-stop missions really were over. Of course, Big Billy in his heyday would accept no excuse for people not becoming a Christian. You say, Billy, but I've come with friends. Never mind, the friends will wait. You come. And then other people, Billy would identify, but you say, Billy, I'm on a coach. Never mind, we've told the coaches to wait. You come. But Billy, I'm on the balcony. Never mind, you jump. We'll catch you. You come. Hundreds of you. You come. And they did. And amongst the many hundreds who came, it transpired that way back they had believing grandparents who'd prayed for them since the cradle. They'd had Sunday school, religious education of some substance at school. But of course, the folk we tend to be working with now don't have the praying grandparents and the RK in school and so on and so forth. So the idea of one-stop evangelism is less and less realistic. One of the first jobs I had to do in my first year of full-time Christian ministry was to follow up a mission. And we had about 100 folk who filled in response cards, and 65 of them turned up the following week to these sort of alpha-type groups, let's use that as a generic term, okay? These discovery groups. And it's quite interesting, many of the 65 who turned up the following week after the mission, many of these folk had professed faith, had ticked the box that they'd prayed the prayer. We got all of them to say at the end of another gospel presentation where they stood. You know, the two ways to live, are you under your authority or God's authority? Now, I wonder how many you think, just one week after professing faith, how many of those folk, having heard a clear gospel presentation again, having had a week to think about it, having gone back to the living girlfriend, boyfriend, all the rest of it, what percentage of those 65 do you think were able to say, yeah, I have become a Christian? How many of you think more than 50%? Okay. How many of you think more than 30%? How many of you don't like putting your hands up? Okay. Okay. How many of you think 10% or more? Yeah, that's what I would have thought. But we got a big, fat 0%. And I was at the events, and the gospel was very, very clearly presented. And what emerged to those of us leading these groups was you know, the Lord was doing something in their lives, and they knew it, but they needed to come and learn Christ. And over the weeks and the months, they learned Christ, and many came to faith. And I think some of the church growth groups, like Willow Creek, have taught us the Engels scale. I should have prepared an acetate for this, forgive me. But if you imagine a scale, a line going across here, naught is here, 10 is there. At 10, people are converted. At naught, people absolutely hate the gospel, not quite sold their souls to the devil, but they're as far back as you can imagine. Now, the sort of people that Billy Graham was able to appeal to come to faith were sort of around 8 and 9. They had all this background, and they really just needed to be told to repent, given an opportunity to come home. Now, many of the experts reckon to get people who are largely, by and large, the majority of people, sort of around 2 or 3. They don't know much about the gospel and are instinctively hostile to some of the unique claims. Other religions are wrong. There is hell. There is judgment. Most people are around 2 or 3. Now, obviously, we've got fringe church members who might be around 6, 7. But the majority of folk, to get from 2, 3 to conversion, it's going to take about 10 years. And so process evangelism became very popular, rightly so. And there's, of course, a good new pack, Christianity Explored. I saw the posters, and I think an event launching that here in Glasgow. I think something's going to be said from the front, but I would commend that to you and ask you to look out for that. And by and large, the vast majority of people who are willing to go through these various courses, those folk who will commit to 2 to 3 months of weekly instruction are on the fringe of church. Nominal churchgoers, I suppose, make up a lot of our fringe. Untaught mums who maybe come once a month to family services, or mums and tots. And of course, there are many others. There are non-Christian boyfriends, girlfriends, wives, husbands of folk who are in our church. And they're very much on the fringe. And so they're a good target. Now, on the basis of that slightly simplistic analysis, I'd like to suggest there are 3 challenges for congregational evangelism. The first is we need to work with the fringe. Look after those the Lord has actually given you, who will, at the drop of a hat, tend to come to your better evangelistic events, the occasional evangelistic thrusts on Sundays. Encourage them to go on these things, the family weeks, the Easter or summer events, and keep exposing them to the gospel. Look after them, befriend them. They are there. And if you don't have a fringe, then I think your work is really cut out. I know of a handful of churches in England who pride themselves on not having a fringe. And the church are the remnant few who are very happy in their smallness and the purity of their membership. Now, I doubt that's you. I suspect you wouldn't have come to this if you had that remnant mentality. Now, I'm not going to focus in this session on reaching your existing fringe, since I reckon, now, again, I'm plucking this figure out of thin air, and this is more a comment on the churches I've worked for, but I reckon about 95% of our evangelistic efforts are with the fringe. Now, there's a lot going on for them, and I think that's great, but the fringe is declining. Statistically, the fringe is declining, and also we found in our church that since we put them through alpha-type courses, that we're finding it harder and harder to get an alpha off the ground, you know, with a good 15 or so non-Christians. We managed to get 2 to the last one, for starters. And, of course, there's also the good old non-Christians who perennially, you know, can be recycled into any event we're doing. They sort of quite enjoy their identity as the unbeliever because they get so much good food and attention. And I think they suspect that they wouldn't get such good attention if they were ever converted. So the fringe, hopefully, if we're doing evangelism, is going to diminish in terms of its original composition. Now, I'm more concerned with the 2 remaining challenges, and that's going to take up our time. 1 is to increase the fringe, and 2, to evangelize those beyond the fringe. Okay, so you can see it's not rocket science, is it? Increase the fringe and evangelize those beyond the fringe. And I think the key to rising to both of these challenges is our congregations. We can't do this ourselves, can we, as ministers? If you go back from this ministry assembly and simply start a new evangelistic program, however good, or announce a particular event, you won't necessarily move forward. Because really, it's the congregations who have the family, the neighbours, the colleagues. I hope most of you don't have non-Christian colleagues. So we don't have so much opportunity for making that contact. And I think we've got to inculcate our members with convictions about and confidence in what we're seeking to do. And for my part, I think ownership is the key ingredient of collaborative ministry. It's not enough for us just to be faithful to the things we've done. You know, we're preaching the gospel at 6:30, we'll be faithful to that. We're praying as if prayer is a magic wand. Prayer is not the power of God to salvation. It is non-Christians hearing the word of God that is, if you like, that's where God's power is revealed. So we can't wave the magic wand of prayer as much as we should pray. We can't just be faithful to the things that haven't worked, because that sort of faithfulness becomes damaging and discouraging to our congregations. So ownership is key. One of the people who's challenged me most on this is a surgeon called Bernard Palmer. He was going to go into full-time ministry, but he worked for Dick Lucas at the time. He was just did a year of full-time ministry, and Dick said to him in his inimitable way, "No, Bernard, you don't have what it takes to go full-time. Go and be a surgeon and lots of money and buy a big house and do evangelism from there." And so Bernard did as he was told, and he became a surgeon. And earned lots of money and bought a big house. And every quarter, he holds these amazing evangelistic suppers in his house. And he's gathered around a core of people from the church with the vicar's blessing. In fact, the vicar always turns up and stopped wearing his dog collar, which is a real step forward, certainly at these events. And the great thing is, Bernard leads by example. So as I was milling around, there were about 100 unbelievers at this supper. I mean, it really is a vast house. We're in the drawing room. We're in the drawing room for the supper, and then we moved into the billiard room, where all the chairs are arranged like this to sit down for the event. Well, Bernard had loads of his patients there. Not only do they think he's a great guy for saving their life, he's a cancer patient, but as they go out, his registrar gives them invitations to the next supper with Bernard, and they turn up. Now, the rest of the court, they all had two or three non-Christian friends in tow. Somehow, Bernard got a corps together who would own this event. You know, what will it take for you to bring your friends to this? What will make it plausible? What will make it non-cringy? Will it work if we do this? Will it not work if we do that? So he got ownership, and any Christians going along to that are utterly inspired. And you think, yes, I could do that. And it is worth looking in your congregations for key individuals around whom you could start evangelism, you could get a core. A minister friend of mine in Sydney, he realized that nobody was doing evangelism in the church. He didn't really know how to do it, but he noticed there was one member of the congregation, socially competent, always had non-Christians in tow, and he said to this person, he said, look, could you do something in your house, and I could do a talk at it, and we could invite a few Christians just to see it happening. And the friend said, yeah, sure. And that sparked off a whole sort of program of supper party type events. So it may be that the way to get the congregation going in the first place is to identify somebody with that sort of natural ability with people and to use them as a model. Give people permission to do stuff that's outside the walls of the church. But what I'm really driving at is we need to get convictions, principles and strategies first before we just come out with programs. So let's try and get those principles and strategies from Scripture. And we're going to take a quick look at the Apostle Paul at work. And we're going to allow the convictions and principles and practical ideas to emerge from the sort of backdrop we'll get from that. Now, I don't know what I've done with my case. Can anybody see my schoolboy case? Somewhere there, I've got a Bible. If you would turn to Acts chapter 17. Thank you very much. We'll just look at a few verses here. Whilst you're turning to Acts 17, let me just say a couple of things about it. It is a relevant context. Many commentators are suggesting that Britain is more and more like Athens, certainly more like Athens than like Jerusalem. And yet I think some of our churches do still speak the language of Zion rather than the language of Athens to those who come along. Now, the locals Paul speaks to from verse 16, whether he's in... certainly in the marketplace, in the Areopagus, not so much in the synagogue, but they're pagan, whether they're upright, self-sufficient Stoics or pleasure-seeking Epicureans, of verse 18. It's the same sort of mentality, live for now. As for religion, for them it didn't matter exactly what you believed, so long as you've got a spirituality, so long as you have a God, a focus for your religious motions. So here in Athens, there was a plurality of religions, many altars and idols, verses 16 and 23. There was a plurality of philosophies, Epicureans and Stoics, verse 18. And there was a plurality of ideas and opinions, verse 20. This sounds like a modern media context, doesn't it? The sort of footnote of Luke. All the Athenians, verse 21, and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Verse 21. And all this existed in a climate of tolerance, pluralism and tolerance. And it would have been quite impolite for anybody to step into this situation and be narrow-minded enough to criticize their idolatry. And lots of commentators are suggesting that we are more like the Greco-Roman world now and this part of the 21st century than any era since Paul's day. So the world now is increasingly linked to a single language and an overarching culture, sadly supplied by film and TV and modern music. And within that, people adopt their own distinctives, don't they? They're in little tribes. But this is bang up to date. So it's very encouraging that there is good material to get principles from and ideas from here in Paul's Areopagus address. So I want us to notice three things about Paul. Let me just read a bit of it. First thing I want you to spot is the first point of Paul's convictions. Verse 16. While Paul was waiting, this is for Timothy and Silas in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. Paul knew the gospel was true, so when he saw idolatry, he was provoked, verse 16. He was deeply stirred. He was so convinced that there was one true God who had made the world that when he saw anything that was a blatant contradiction of that, there was a stirring within. And that's what spurred him, verse 17, to reason in the synagogue, the marketplace, and with anybody who happened to be there. And I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of this conviction, that the gospel is true. It's propositionally true. It's not just my story. It's not just true for me. And I think many folk in our congregations are losing confidence here. We collude easily with a postmodern view of, you know, this is my story. Let's share it as my story. I made that mistake some years ago when I put on a supper party type thing. It wasn't quite as grand as that for some blokes in my village. About 10 of them came. We had some beers and some eats. And I told them the gospel as best I knew how. I used the vehicle of my testimony, so I thought I'd get away with more if I said, you know, when I was a teenager, I heard that unless I believed this, I'd be going to hell. There's a sense in which they can't tell me off for saying that because this is my story. And in a postmodern world, my story is valid and important. If that's what I heard, that's what I heard. But I sort of became hostage to fortune to that sort of vehicle because in the question time, it emerged that nobody was remotely offended by what I'd said. They hadn't understood it as anything other than my story. They said, oh, this is really nice for you. Is this what you tell the students? That's great. So I thought, boy, I've got to do some work here. So I tried to sharpen up what I said, and I recast it and tried to make it clear that what I was saying was public truth, that Jesus was God or he wasn't, that it was true or it wasn't, that we were going to heaven or hell. And there came a moment in the evening when the penny really dropped for these folk, and there was a sudden surge of noise, and they were all saying at once, you can't possibly say that, you can't possibly believe that. I know that there was a sudden moment because Ruth, my wife, two floors up, came down, thinking she needed to break up a fight, and she was a bit concerned. These guys are married to her best friends, and she thought, you know, I've got to break them apart. Now, we were, metaphorically speaking, fighting each other when she walked into the kitchen, but once I'd assured her this was good male bonding and this is how we like to spend evenings, she went back upstairs and left us. But we had a great evening, but it wasn't until they heard the gospel was more than my story that they had the opportunity to understand it, to be angry at it, to have convictions about it. And this was very much Paul's conviction, that they couldn't just have their religious views. And much of Paul's boldness, I think, and his motivation comes from this stirring. But notice how he responds. He's so stirred, verse 17, what does he do? He's so stirred, so angry, so provoked, he reasons. When I first became a Christian, I was 12, 13 at school. I went with a briefcase to school with Jesus stickers on it. That's sad for two reasons, of course. But anyway, I had a briefcase and I had Jesus stickers on it. And I had a few spare stickers, so I put them on the loo doors at school. And Ian Thompson, who no doubt was, the devil was just using him as his instrument, had the temerity to pull off some of these stickers. Now, I was provoked. And so I did the only Christian thing and punched him in the face. And some years later in the sixth form, Ian, we became friends, but many years later, he said, Richard, you know, from that moment on, I decided I was going to hate you. And I did, until I got to know you in the sixth form. So you can see what sort of a witness I was. So we mustn't confuse conviction with irritation. If we in our preaching are merely irritated by people's lifestyles, their morality, their music, we won't be reasoning, we'll be ranting, and the congregation will lose confidence. I think I couldn't possibly invite my friends, my family, my neighbours to hear this, because our pastor, our ministers just hates the sort of things that they do and they stand for so much. Francis Schaeffer, who in the 60s picked up lots of hippies who had very immoral lifestyles, drugs and free love, so-called. He instructed a number of his workers. He said, look, there's going to be a lot about these people you won't like. But when you stand up and preach the gospel to them, ask yourself this one question. Do I love these people? And if the answer's no, shut up and sit down. Because you'll just cut their ears off. And they won't hear anything about the big issues of heaven and hell. And so it is striking that Paul, although provoked, he's polite, he's intelligent, he's engaging, he refers to their shrine, he quotes their poetry, he acknowledges the art and the imagination of men, but he saves all his fire, doesn't he, for the false ideas. Verse 23, what you worship unknowingly, literally ignorantly, and I'm going to proclaim it to you. And then after this very tightly reasoned expose of their idolatry, without criticizing their architecture or their poetry, but rather using it, verse 30, he says, now you've got to repent of ignorance, of getting it so wrong about God. Now we've got to develop for ourselves increasingly and pass on the convictions to our church members that the gospel really is true and therefore relevant to all areas of life. Whether it's family life, work, morality, film, music, art. The Bible speaks either directly or indirectly into all areas of life. A group I worked with on a course called Discovering Christianity, we became really convinced that Christianity, because it was true, would speak directly or indirectly into all areas of life. And it was quite interesting that on the strength of those convictions, many of these leaders were not only doing the set piece stuff in church, but were organizing debates in pubs, watching films with non-Christian friends. And if they chose a good film with a good bite to it, they could show the Christian perspective, the world view. I was even invited on a holiday with a couple of Christian friends. They had 8 non-Christian friends in tow. And they showed me a couple of films, one of which was The Life of Brian. And they said, get out of that. Christianity is really explained by the Python's view that Jesus could have been anybody, that his words have been so, you know, sort of misunderstood, that he could have just as easily said, blessed are the cheesemakers as blessed are the peacemakers. Now, my sensibilities were offended by that film, but so what? We're not interested, are we, in whether our sensibilities are offended, but whether there is an opportunity to engage and to confront and to prosecute unbelief. I'm sure Elijah's sensibilities were severely offended when he asked the prophets of Baal to do their best on Mount Carmel. He had to sit through that. But he sat through it, and then he showed them who the real God was. Now, there are so many people, 90% probably of the contacts, the friends, the family, the colleagues of our parishioners, they're beyond the fringe. And it's going to be a very long time before they're ready to make a commitment. So it's really important that our Christians realize they can have serious conversations with people that indirectly or directly commend the Christian worldview. The gospel is only that far from any serious conversation. Our neighbor commented some time ago that she was a little bit concerned that we smacked our kids. Now, we do smack our kids. It's not a hobby of ours, but from time to time... You know, they need that encouragement. They need the pat on the back that is low enough and hard enough, as Billy Graham used to say, to send them on their merry way. And she said, how can you do that as a Christian? And I actually said that I had confidence to do that because of the biblical view of human nature and so on and so forth. Now, she was quite intrigued that the Bible could speak with such precision, such explanatory power into the human condition. And she realized that she could actually do with a few lessons from the Bible herself on bringing up children. We've got an interesting situation in our church in North Oxford. It is quite unique. In the square mile, there's 100% employment. The average price of houses is £1 million. It is just, I mean, I've never seen anywhere quite like it, but the result of having all these university dons and civil servants and all the rest of it, old Oxford families living here, authors and you name it, the Jeremy Paxmans of this world, living around there, is that all evangelism that happens in church is too gauche. You know, people have just found that what they would call dishonest evangelism just doesn't work, where you have a wine tasting with an epilogue, don't judge a bottle by its label, and they think, oh no, they hear the grunching of gears as the gospel gets, you know, pulled out. And these guys are intelligent, sophisticated, they can see it coming. So, of course, the Christians don't invite their friends to what we would think, what I would think, would be a perfectly good thing to do. So I've got a couple of events. I've just started this job coming up in the autumn. Now, you might think they're absolutely rubbish for your situation, but if you think of my situation and some of the principles I'm applying, hopefully there's transfer value there. We have a guy called Joe Pilling in our congregation. He's the permanent secretary for Northern Ireland. And we're doing an event on a Sunday night based around him and a converted terrorist who's not in our congregation, surprise, surprise. And for 15 minutes, we're looking at how did the situation get here. Joe's getting the media department at Whitehall to produce a 15-minute video of how things got there, so it's going to be really slick. 15 minutes, Joe's going to tell us his testimony, effectively, how being a Christian informs his job, and so on. David Hamilton, one of the most powerful testimonies. Has anybody heard David Hamilton? He's now in Manchester. Yeah, I mean, really, it's just the most powerful testimony. I've done a number of university missions in recent years, and I've used David there. And he's going to show how God breaks into that. Now, as far as the congregation are concerned, here's Joe Pilling. They know him. He's respected. They love their friends to hear what he's got to say. It's all about a political situation. North Oxford chattering classes love to talk about this sort of thing. And it won't be a bolt-on gospel, but it will. The whole evening will show from beginning to end that the Bible has explanatory power to speak into the situation, but more significantly, I suppose, or more profoundly, it has transforming power. We see Joe Pilling and David Hamilton, their lives turned around. And for them, that's more plausible. We're doing it on a Sunday night because the people are busy. If we did it midweek, not so many would turn up. And all sorts of people would come and think, this is sad, it's not successful. I don't like to associate with things that aren't successful. We do it Sunday night because even if there's any one non-Christian, the Christians will think, this is successful. Boy, if there's something else like this again, I must bring my friends. What a wasted opportunity. We want them to start thinking like that. And although he doesn't know it yet, we've got a guy called Andrew Dillnott. He's offered to do stuff, but I've already booked the slot on the Sunday evening, right? He's been too busy with the election. He's the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. He's going to do something on money. He was telling me that his team of researchers, he has 60 researchers, and he says over the past 15 years, the top 6% have got richer, and it's proven that they are also profoundly more unhappy. As they get richer, they get unhappier. So Andrew, on money. And then, of course, some multimedia and a gospel talk. What should it profit a man if he gains the whole world, loses his own soul? The Jesus view on money and acquisition. So these convictions that the gospel speaks into all areas of life because it speaks either directly or indirectly in a truthful way must inform what we do, and I think it will give confidence. So Paul is born up by this conviction. Very quickly, my time's nearly gone. The second point, if conviction is the first, the second thing we learn from Paul is his flexibility. Paul is willing to reach all types of people, isn't he? And he's able to flex culturally in order to achieve that. So, verse 17, he's in the synagogue, standing, so to speak, behind a pulpit with the Old Testament scriptures. He's with the fringe, perfectly happy to be with the fringe. I suppose they regard themselves as the core, but in one sense, fringe of Christianity. They at least have the Old Testament. And then he goes beyond the fringe to the marketplace in the same verse, verse 17. Now, I don't suppose we have a single equivalent, do we, to the marketplace. I suppose it would involve, if we're trying to create the equivalent, it would be pub, neighborhood, sports club, school gate, all combined. And if we're a teenager, street corner and takeaway. Now, one of the things we're trying to do at St. Andrew's this summer is to slightly increase the fringe. Now, again, this isn't rocket science, but it just seems a sensible thing to do, given we've got so many sporty people. It's the summer of sport. So we've had a golf day. That was in May the 30th. We've got cricket matches, tennis tournaments, bowls tournaments, five-a-side football, various team sports, and then 7th of September, a sports dinner. We're going to present the prizes from these various tournaments, a chance for the people who played each other in the teams to mix again and have eats and drinks together, and I'll be doing a short after-dinner speech. Now, what we're trying to say to the Christians is, we know you're playing sport anyway, we know you've got lots of non-Christian friends, but try and do some joined up. Try and see if there's some momentum here. Try and see if you can just get them interested in meeting other Christians, in hearing something of the gospel. And maybe they'll become more fringe. Maybe we're then in a position to invite them to the next thing. And it might be the alpha-type course eventually, once they really do feel fringe and they recognize the Christians, they like the company. I think momentum is the key here. We do lots of events, but what do we do with the momentum that's generated through them? So verse 17, we see him flexing to the different types of people. And when the opportunity comes, of course, verse 22, he speaks to the ruling council of the city. And the result of all this is verse 32, the fringe is increased. Many of the Areopagus said, we're going to hear you again. This is interesting. Obviously, there were mockers. But then, of course, there were also converts. Now, again, what really lies beneath the surface of this willingness to flex, where he'll speak in the synagogue from Jewish scriptures, he'll also go to the marketplace and to the Areopagus without the safety of the pulpit? I think it's all about, of course, the gospel, isn't it? And he tells us in 1 Corinthians 9:22 that it's a lifestyle for him to flex. He'll become a Jew to the Jew, a Greek to the Greek, strong to the strong, weak to the weak. In fact, I'll become all things to all people, to all men, that by all means I might save some. And then at the end of this section, at 11:1, he says, be an imitator of me as much as I am of Christ, who, of course, by his incarnation, related to people, came in their language, humanity, and was constantly criticized by the religious traditionalists for actually being with people where they were, so that they felt comfortable at their parties with tax collectors and sinners. We can't get away from it, that this is a gospel issue. There's a chap who I did a mission with, James Lawrence. You'll probably know his excellent material, Lost for Words, CPAS chap. He tells the story of when he went to the dogs. So that sounds unpromising. He went to a dog race with a non-Christian friend. And forgive me if I don't get the details entirely right, but his recollection is something like this. He said, I realized that I was wearing clothes totally different to everybody else. He said, I didn't know whether I was meant to stand or sit when the races were beginning and ending. He said, I had a book with the form and the betting protocol, and he said, I didn't know which page to turn to, and of course, I'm sure we're pleased he didn't. And he said, everyone, especially from the commentary, spoke a language I didn't understand. And he said, all evening, I felt like a child, utterly de-skilled. Now, of course, when Paul does evangelism, people never feel that they're wearing the wrong things. People never feel that they don't know their way around. They never feel de-skilled and childlike because he flexes. He becomes all things to them. And I'm sure when people come into our church on a Sunday, if they do come to the odd family service, for them, a Sunday is relaxing family time. They don't want to be wearing a suit by and large. So that's just a minor detail, but in terms of the books we give them, the clothes we wear, the language we use, how we decorate our halls, and all the rest of it, are we really saying at our events, let alone our regular services, that it is open to people who aren't part of this subculture, which all those things are? Those are not gospel things, are they? Suits and all the rest of it. They're just a subcultural attachment, neither good nor bad in and of themselves, but in certain contexts they are bad. So how comfortable and welcome would the non-fringe person feel if they come to our events? John Rushen was telling me that at the Tron, I think a couple of weeks ago, they had a golf evening. Who was anybody here part of that? No, okay. Well, apparently a couple of professional golfers came in, and it was dads, blokes, who were beyond the fringe, who they had never really come to anything churchy before, but I assume through possibly converted wives and all the rest of it, they managed to get them to come for an evening of coaching. And they whacked their plastic balls, they were videoed, taken into a side room, and then given 5 minutes of coaching on their style. And all 50 guys, had their style analyzed. And then they went through for a supper, and these golf professionals gave their testimony. And the blokes are just thrilled. This is brilliant. This is great. Are there more people like this? Now, there's a sense in which, again, we can't just produce professional golfers out of a hat every week, but you generate momentum, don't you? You get something going. You inspire confidence. You get people within the orbit of church, and you can go somewhere with that. So why not spend the odd session before your midweek meeting, your Bible study or prayer meeting, thinking through how the church and its members can live out this principle of flexibility? Ask your church members, what would it take for them to feel comfortable to bring their friends? And ask them to list at some point who their non-Christian neighbors, family, friends, colleagues are. And it may be that able Christians can pair up and do stuff together for similar types of friends. And again, often it says with vision, convictions, and flexibility, who are going to be more junior in years. And it may be that we've got to go over the heads of some of the elders in our church, some of the people who head up the working parties or whatever you call them, the teams who tend to run everything. It may be that they just really haven't got the vision for this. So you may have to promote others. And I realize that there can be blood on the carpet when you do things like that. Because not everyone's going to be enthusiastic and share your convictions to increase the fringe and reach out beyond the fringe. So target key Christians, invite them around for meals, disciple them, share your vision, so you create a core of people who will own a new strategy or a new initiative. Now my third point, I suspect I don't have time for it, which is a shame, but it was communication. It was really a challenge to us in how we communicate the gospel. Because again, I think if our parishioners and members are going to, with confidence, bring their friends, their family, their colleagues to events, they've got to be sure that we're not going to talk past those who come, that we are actually going to decentralize a bit. We're going to get rid of religious jargon. Now, there's a whole section on that. I've run out of time, so forgive me for that. I think I will leave that unless the first question is, what were you going to say? So the three points as we need. I think we do need convictions that we have to have, that we need to inculcate our congregation with, about the truth and therefore the relevance of the gospel. That creates energy, that creates momentum. And with that sort of under the surface, then the sort of creative vocabulary of ideas will actually see the light of day. Without that, we can, you know, suggest anything, and it's likely to die a death. And we mustn't say, oh, we're being faithful. We had the idea. We put up the poster. We booked the room. Unless we've really got the core, we've got the vision shared, we've got the convictions shared, then I don't think we're doing all we can. And then the flexibility of ourselves, of our church structures, of our members. And then lastly, there's no time for this. I think we've got to do serious work on communication, on actually removing the language of Zion, the Christian cliches, the parsonic voices. And you see, I'm slipping some of this in, which we do so well. I'll just tell you this. Bill Hybels' response to jargon is fourfold. He says, eliminate Christian cliche, you know, whether it's Calvary, the blood of Christ, accepted Jesus into my heart. It may be precious to us, but it really is at best meaningless. Increasingly to those who don't have church background. Learn unchurch Harry's language. Try to use everyday words rather than technical and religious ones. Simplify the theology, which we see Paul doing. No time to bring that out. And use a normal tone of voice. Preferably the normal conversational one we have with our family and all the rest of it, rather than like the slightly condescending headmaster, which we can get into, can't we, so easily. Especially if we're running the show ourselves. I'll finish with this quote. Henry Chadwick said of Paul, his genius as an apologist is his astonishing ability to reduce to an apparent vanishing point the gulf between himself and his converts, and yet to gain them for the Christian gospel. Over to you for questions and comments. And if you accept the structure, it'd be good to work with how do we increase the fringe? How do we reach those with evangelism, congregational evangelism, who are beyond the fringe?
Sure, you're as grateful as I am to Richard for stimulating us with that address. I hope it's been an encouragement to you. Even if you don't have a parish where there are homes worth £1 million+, whatever. Are there any questions? We've got about just over 15 minutes for questions. We'll have to keep to time. We need to be out of here at 2:55, but are there any questions? Five past three. Sorry, I was told 5:55. Right, 5:55. We've got a bit longer then. You could ask about communication.
You could do another. I've only got 2 points.
Oh, well. Who'd like to start us off?
I think that's a problem, you know.
Okay.
Our language is so different.
Well, you've obviously gone extra 10
minutes. Give us some ideas there.
Okay. That's very kind of you. I'll pay you later. Okay. Well, I've essentially got 2 points, but they all have sub-points. And the first thing I want to suggest is that we need to, in our preparation and certainly our delivery, is grasp the two main horizons. Sorry, that's tiny, isn't it? But I'll explain it to you. We've got two horizons we've got to reach. The first is the biblical text. We've got to get our information, as Paul did, even though he didn't hold up a Bible and quote the verses. He got all his information about the sovereign God who doesn't need anyone and so on from the text. Now, if we take the text and just say, right, I'm going to be faithful to this, without taking any notice of the contemporary setting, the horizon, where the people we're speaking to are at, the danger is we'll just sort of not expound the text, but expand it. We'll just talk about the details of the verses, and we'll tend to be talking more about Greek verbs and context and all the rest of it than we will actually speaking to people. And if we just hold on to that horizon, it's going to be very hard to engage. Of course, if we just speak where people are at without holding on to the horizon of the biblical text and what that has to say, we will be entertaining, we will be engaging, but we'll become heretical because we will omit to say the things that make them uncomfortable. The uniqueness of Christ, his peculiar claims to truth, judgment, hell, heaven, and so on. So we've got to fuse both horizons. And I find it very helpful in my preparation as I sort of pray to the Lord to try and penetrate the text to see what the big idea of the text is. I then think, okay, John 14, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. That's the main argument of the text. What are the presuppositions, the prior assumptions of my listeners that are going to stop them hearing that and taking that on board? How can Jesus possibly say that? Maybe he doesn't mean it. Maybe he's being arrogant. And so one begins in the delivery of that material to critique the presuppositions. Forget that word, we didn't have time to explain that. The presuppositions, the prior assumptions of our audience, and then to restate. Now, if in our preparation we're thinking of where they are, what the text is saying, what they're going to hear when we say this, how we diffuse their misunderstanding, their rejection of that, then whilst our speech is a monologue, it will have all the hallmarks of a dialogue, won't it? People think, wow, that was as if it was just for me. He was anticipating my problem with that, and he explained it. And I would suggest there are 3 elements of double listening. It's what John Stott calls double listening. And they are identification, prosecution, and invitation. So very quickly, in 2 minutes. Identification. I think this should inform our prep and our delivery. I do quite a lot of training of university lunch bar speakers, and I make them use these categories. And when we assess their talks, we ask, first of all, did they identify where their audience were, locate them, their mindset, their attitude, their approach? And did they identify with them? And one of the best ways of doing that, I'm not talking about all the background work of reading and sort of understanding the world, which we must do, as Paul did, listen carefully and looked at their objects of worship. But we must use appropriate illustration. That's our way in. I think the first illustration, you know, if we're talking about our arthritic aunt in Aberdeen and we're talking to the young people, you know, it's possibly not going to give them any confidence that we understand their world. So illustration is the way in. And that's what Paul does, 22. He uses their shrine. He sets up the riddle that they're genuinely interested in. Who is the unknown God? And they're hooked. He gets their mindset exactly. He uses their poetry, their philosophy, their ideas. He's just totally on their level. Which is why when he delivers his punch, saying, this is why this ignorance is culpable, that they just can't escape it. There's a massive reaction to him. And I think our opening minutes with an audience or a congregation are crucial. We've got to locate them and identify with them. But then, of course, it's not good enough to locate where they are. We've got to prosecute the false ideas. Having identified with them and where they are, we detonate the explosive of the gospel to show that we cannot think like that. It is foolish, wrong, dangerous. Can't live like this. Human relationships don't work like this. Prosecute what is false. But then lastly, invite. Invite them, rather than just leaving them, ha, got you. I know where you are, and I'm saying in key points you're in danger, you're wrong. We need to actually say, this is really good news. We know what good news is like, don't we? It's wonderful to hear. Come, repent, change. Move from being under God's wrath to actually coming under his love and into his family. And that's exactly what Paul does. So we identify, we prosecute, and we invite. And if we have those three ingredients in our preparation, I do believe that our evangelistic talks will have a bit more of a dialogical nature. But it won't be so much that the first bit of the talk is invitation, the second bit is prosecution, the third is... But there's a sense in which it will permeate the whole. There will always be that threefold approach that people hear us where they are, and they feel a bit uncomfortable because they've been exposed to where they are, but they also feel valued because they know that we want them to change to a place of safety and goodness. So there we have it. That's in just over 2 minutes. Okay, you may or may not want to respond to that, but back to our questions. You're probably wondering why I bothered, aren't you?
There was a questioner over here in a sort of purple shirt.
Yeah, I wanted to come back and think about the conversational style. I wonder if the style of authority, is that your message is about the view of the message that you're projecting? It's a conversational style. Mm.
That's a really good point. I think, there is a sense in which, you know, we find ourselves sometimes in the pulpit where we are genuinely caught up with the bigness of the gospel, the glory of the gospel. And we do get an extra energy and an extra volume that we wouldn't use when talking one-to-one in a conversation. But I don't think we should ever adopt that as a style. I think, you know, when that unction comes and we are transported by the bigness of what we're doing, and the Holy Spirit moves us to speak like that. But I think our bread and butter approach to conveying, to teaching what the Bible is saying, I think we should avoid speaking in a way that is unnatural, that will sound unnatural. And I think people pick that up. If they hear something that's clear, that's rational, that's sane, and